Hey guys, you hear about little Johnny going trick-or-treating?
No.
Little Johnny. Yeah,
little Johnny goes trick-or-treating as a pirate.
Yeah.
He wraps to the first three, goes, trick-or-treat. And the lady comes out and goes, wow, what are you? He goes, I'm a pirate. She goes, where's your buccaneers? He goes, under my bucking hatch, it's going to be some fucking candy.
Hey, man. Welcome to the Big Bad Broadcast, dude.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Big Bad Broadcast. We're here every week where you get your podcast. And we have a great show for you today. We have nothing. Now we have Mike Grief.
Thanks for introducing me as we got nothing. We got nothing. We got Mike Grief. Nothing.
We got, we got Craig Mitchell.
Oh. I'm more nothing.
Thank more you. Nothing.
I'm more nothing.
Wouldn't that be less nothing?
That's less than zero.
Less than zero.
Good movie.
I never saw it.
What?
Less than nothing.
What?
What is it about? I have no
clue. It's Andrew McCarthy. Andrew McCarthy and Jamie Gertz and Robert Downey Jr. is a rich drug addict.
A rich drug. Well, there you go. There's a whole new topic. So it's a reality show.
Basically, it's a great movie. I won't give away the ending.
Don't give away the ending because I may watch. I did watch a movie the other day. Well, it's a documentary, but I watched the Yogi Berra thing. Have you seen that?
Well, which one?
No, I remember as a kid, he was a spokesman for Yoohoo.
Yoohoo.
You
didn't see the new documentary with Yogi Berra? It's called It Ain't Over.
No, you just sent it to me last night. I didn't have time.
Ten rings. That's all I'm saying.
Ten rings as a player, but he has like 12 or 13. But he has like then a couple as a manager, as a coach.
No, he never got a ring as a manager, unfortunately.
Maybe then he got it as a coach because he's got like 13 or 14 rings. He had like something like that.
Well, he managed the Yankees in 1964, and they lost the World Series, and they fired him. Then he managed the Mets in 1973.
He was a coach in 69 when they won the World Series. He got
on the Mets
that year. On the Mets, yes, he was. He got fired from the the Yankees, and he went. And he went to the Mets, and he won. And he was a hitting coach, I think, a batting coach in 69 with the Mets.
He played for the Mets in 1963, and he went 1-for-8, and he retired.
Yeah, well,
The Mets had a lot of old players who played for them, like Duke Snider, Spahn, Willie Mays.
Well, no, anyway, we don't have to talk about that. I was just kind of like amazed.
Yeah, John looks bored already.
I'm not bored at all. When I was a kid, it's funny. I was lucky enough that I was young enough where
Met Abner Doubleday. John met Abner.
John said, look, if you hit this rock with a stick, what I did is I give you Abner.
I was young enough to remember the first black baseball player. No, I was young enough to read the heyday of the Yankees with Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle. I remember Yogi.
Wait. You're saying that's the heyday? I think the heyday of the Yankees
was the end of Babe Ruth. As a kid growing up, to me, that was the heyday. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, but these were guys that you idolized.
Well, so what do you think? Now, do you think the Yankees were better during that period or in the Murderers Row period, you know, with Babe Ruth and all those guys? Lou Gehrig.
Well, the Yankees of the 50s with DiMaggio and Mantle and all those guys, you know, Whitey Ford. And
that's when I was a kid.
That's the 50s. Dad, they won
I was born in 1950.
No, no, but I'm saying the question is what do you think was better? Do you think they were better in that period or do you think they were better back in the
20s? To be really honest, I haven't followed the Yankees since 1959.
I got to tell you, the 27 Yankees are awfully tough to beat on paper.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig with 107 total home runs between them.
Thank God they don't play on paper. They play on a field.
Exactly. You know, and you had Tony Lazzari and you had all, you know, the team was just insanely good.
Running around the corner was the great Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth. I'll tell you that you now, as a kid, I was a baseball fan. You know me, I'm not a fan anymore. I haven't been a sports fan in 1,000 years. But as a kid, you know, I my brother used to take me. He took me to the Mets games. He took me to the Yankees.
No, he left you at the baseball.
And he kept finding his way home.
He's still mad at me to this day about blaming me that I was like 9 years old. He lost me at Yankee Stadium, but that's my fault. But anyway, I remember, you know, that I loved the Mets because, like, this is when they were in their biggest slump. It was in the 70s. And they were just so terrible. There were like, there'd be four people in the stand. So if you wanted a hot dog, I mean, the guy would stand right next to you because there was only four people. So there was four hot dog vendors. You know, you had your own vendors for everything.
They called Shea Stadium Grant's Tomb during that area. It's 77 to 81.
Then afterwards, we would stand outside and I met every player. I met Rusty Staub. I met all the players because, you know, they'd come out and they were like thrilled that there were fans.
Yeah, they bought drugs off you, right?
Yeah, of course. You know, what else?
Chris, my girlfriend Chris, has pictures with her with all, you know, after the game with all the Mets players back then. And, you know, it's just funny.
It was magic. You could just show up. You pay $250 for a upper deck seat and you just walk down. You sit in a box seat. It was great. And
the only thing I can contribute to this whole conversation is, which I think I told you this guy's story years ago, was my brother-in-law was a cop. And he had this little Jewish man on his route. And he said to him, "Let me tell you about how I met the great Babe Ruth." He goes, "One morning I was in the Bronx walking with my friend Stymie, and around the bend we hear rat-tat-tat-tat-rat-tat-tat-tat. I look up, and there is a Stutz Bearcat coming around the corner. And who is it at 3 o'clock? He goes, at like 6 o'clock in the morning, but the great Babe Ruth, the king of SWAT. He's coming along in the car, and we go, oh, no, it's the big Bambino. We need to meet him. So he stops at the light. We run up, and we jump on the running boards of his car, and he looks at us and goes, get the fuck off my car, you little bastards. And that's how I met the great Babe Ruth.
The great Babe Ruth.
You want to hear a true story?
I'm so proud of that story.
Want to hear a true story? Is that true? Yeah,
that is a true story.
All right. Well, this one's true too. My mother's father, my grandfather, used to work with the unions in New York City in the 20s and 30s. And on Sunday morning, she lived in a cold water flat on Jane Street in the Village. And one morning she comes up, she's like 5 years old, and she sees somebody sleeping on her couch. And she goes over, and her mother goes, no, don't wake up your Uncle Herman. And she never met her Uncle Herman. She goes, Uncle Herman?
Herman, wait. Like, wasn't that the middle name of somebody famous?
Yes.
Okay, then I know.
Yeah, and she found out that Uncle Herman had gone out drinking with her father the night before, and he was too drunk to find his way home, so he crashed on their couch. And that was George Herman Babe.
Herman Babe Ruth.
Wow.
George Herman Babe Ruth.
I remember, you know, the story about Joe Namath. You talk about these athletes that are drunk. This guy was saying that the Jets were in the AFC playoff game, and he was waiting outside. He's a reporter, and he says at like 7 o'clock in the morning, Joe Namath comes stumbling up the block with two beautiful blondes, like models.
Right.
And he gets in the elevator and he goes upstairs. He says he calls everybody and goes, "Don't bet on the Jets. He's so drunk he can't even walk." Right. And so all, you know, everyone he calls, they're all changing their bets. And they says he comes down and wins the game. And the player said that until halftime, you didn't even want to be in the huddle with him. Because he just reeked of alcohol.
Reeked and sweating it out of his pores. Yep.
And he says that there were many times where he'd come in at night and sleep in that water tank in the locker room until morning.
Like he was like a hot dog on the city streets. That's how the hot dogs sleep. They sleep in the water.
See, that makes me really wonder about just genetics, and because that's way back in the 70s. He drank until the early 2000s when he was on TV and he was drunk on TV. And now he's like in his 80s. I'm like, man, his liver must be like, you know, superhuman. I mean, how does that happen?
You know what's really crazy too about, you ever see when he does that commercial for ARP? And he goes, that's right, and they'll pick me up for my doctor appointments. Joe Namath never got picked up for a doctor appointment by anybody from the ARP.
No, I know. Give me a break.
A limousine, maybe. At least Uber Black, at least.
Those were the days, my friend. I said, I don't know.
Charles
sports.
Barkley is now on CNN. He has a show.
Right. Barkley?
Yeah, called something the King. Something and the King.
I don't know. He's the voice of Subway.
I watched it last night. Oh my God. You think Biden looks old?
Barkley looks really old.
Oh my God. He has so much makeup on. He looks like he's embalmed.
Really? He's not that old. I mean, how old can
Barkley be? No, I know. And he's always like, he's always a jovial guy, but boy, he looks bad on this show.
Did he lose a lot of weight? Because sometimes when you're heavy and you lose a lot of weight, you look like shit.
No, he just seemed like out of it, you know? Like, they would have a conversation, right? And they would go, and what do you think, Charles? Oh, like this guy called up and goes, I just have to tell you, you know, that years ago, you know, I went to this baseball game and basketball game, and all the kids were waiting for autographs. And Barkley came out and said, these guys won't sign any autographs unless your kid has on their player's jersey.
What a bunch
of pricks. He goes, I certainly couldn't afford to buy my kid a jersey. He goes, and Charles Barkley came by and said, well, of course I'll sign your thing. And he signed it, and he's the greatest basketball player that ever lived. And she goes, wow, Charles, you remember that? He goes, not at all.
Yeah, why would he remember it? I mean,
so but it's random. Just,
but, you know, it's like, even if you don't remember, you lie.
That's like, well, you know, my cousin has one of Shaq's sneakers. He has, you know, and it's like, so I told him, because, you know, Shaq's our boss. So he said, if Shaq ever drops on the show, ask him if he remembers, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm not going to ask him that. He's not going to remember some sneaker he gave to an auction. I think he got it at an auction or something.
However, you know my sports great story. Years ago, I followed hockey news. I was a big Islander fan, and we heard that Brian Trotche was going to join the Islanders. We had read about him in hockey news for like 3 years.
That's an actual magazine, hockey news?
It's a monthly paper that comes out, yeah. And so I was at the Islander game, and they announced that he was going to be playing tomorrow. And my guy sitting next to me says to me, let's just drive to Toronto after the game. I go, okay. We drive to Toronto. We get there early. We go to Cosby's, and we buy Brian Trottier jerseys. And they have to sew them, put the numbers on them, the name. And he goes, pick them up at 3. We pick them up at 3, and we got our Brian Trottier jerseys, number 19. And we were walking in front of the thing, and the bus pulls up, and the Islanders get out. And they run by us, and we see Brian trying to go, Brian, and he runs by us. Years later, I got to meet him, and I said, hey, I was at your first game. And he goes, don't even tell me you were the guys with the jerseys. And I go, really? How would you ever remember that? And he goes, I was a 19-year-old kid. He goes, my first game in the NHL, I get off the bus and I see two guys wearing my jersey. How would I ever forget that?
Yeah, that's nice. That's cool.
You know, that's kind of cool, you know?
Now get your cool shine box. Oh, yeah, you were that guy? Yeah, that's great. Now get your shine box.
So, Craig, you mentioned before that you may have to have a sleep study.
Yeah,
that is the funniest thing ever.
I wake up tired. I don't know. It's just
so you go there, right? And they have a special uncomfortable bed.
Yeah,
and they put about 100
electrodes all over you, and then they go get comfortable, go to sleep.
Yeah,
and you can't. But they told me to show up at 8 o'clock, and I fall asleep at 2 in the morning.
Exactly, 8 o'clock, lights out.
No, you know what I had to do? I
took up for 5 more hours than that.
I took one of those, and what you got to do is you got to go there, and I think I took the Trazodone or whatever. I took something to make sure I would sleep because I had tried to take one before, and I couldn't sleep.
But you're not supposed to be medicated. It's supposed to be your natural sleep.
Well, it doesn't matter. The point I'm doing the same thing on a regular sleep as I am in a fucking drug addled sleep. You know,
when I did it, the room in the middle of the night, I woke up and I thought I had malaria. The sheets were soaking wet. I was soaking wet. The leaves were popping off. And they come in and they go, oh, we're really sorry, but the air conditioner just went out. You know, try to go back to sleep. I'm like, yeah. Are you kidding me? It's like 100 degrees in this room.
It's stupidest terrible thing. It's like, come on, man. They make you as uncomfortable as you could possibly be. And then go, yeah, no, go ahead.
Just
go
give
to
me
sleep.
A CPAP. I honestly, just give me a CPAP and we'll set it on medium. See what happens.
Meanwhile,
they got to make sure that you have sleep apnea. But you know what? Anyone who's like overweight and a certain age is going to have sleep apnea. I mean, everyone I know who's overweight has sleep apnea.
Meanwhile, the CPAP is the worst thing in the world. You can't.
I hate them. I gave mine away. I gave it away. I cannot sleep
at all.
You guys are filling me with confidence. You know that, right?
Well, you know what? Well, it may work for you. They come out with more comfortable masks. The masks are so friggin' I couldn't stand it. It's just like, you know, and do you sleep?
Somebody said you get one that only covers your nose. Don't get the one that goes over your mouth.
Let's see, and I'm just the opposite. The one that went just over my nose.
I breathe out of my mouth.
So hurt like hell.
And then meanwhile, in the morning you go, there's an app on your phone. And in the aura, and there's a thing on the machine.
And it tells you how you slept.
And in the morning, you wake up and you go, I made it through the night. And you look over and it says, mask leak. Where it's like, so the whole thing was for shit.
I don't know, man.
You turn over and it leaks a little bit, it's no good.
You can't win. The most you can hope for is to freaking die in your sleep or die without too much pain. I mean, really.
Yeah, thanks for your encouragement.
We've gone from
sleep study to death in your sleep. That's good. I'm happy about it.
You do the death in your sleep. What about that guy they're going to execute?
Oh, the new Alabama method. They have a new method. They haven't had anything new since 1982. What's this, nitrogen asphyxia or something like that?
Yeah.
Where they just...
So, and if it doesn't work, they can give them a root canal.
Yeah.
So
Just put a CPAP on them.
Here's a little background to educate my fellow guys.
John knows all about the death penalty.
I saw John Oliver's special on it. So anyway, apparently the drug companies, they used to give you a drug cocktail.
Right.
And the olive is what killed you.
No. There you go. I feel like James Bond. I'm dying, but I'm James Bond.
One of the drugs paralyzed you.
Yeah.
And then the next stopped your heart. And they stopped with the paralyzing part of the drug, and they won't supply the...
I love it. I love it. A drug company that supplies, you know, drugs for like, you know, for kids and, you know, like... This is the most immoral people that you could possibly imagine. And here they are, they're too moral to help somebody die.
Right.
Somebody to death.
Kill somebody.
The same people who were handing out the Oxycontin to every, you know, like made sure that half the population was addicted to that shit. They're too moral to freaking supply death drugs for murderers.
So what happened was a couple of the prisons tried to do it with just that one drug where it stops the breathing and with some sort of calming agent, and it was really unsuccessful. After about 3 minutes of the guy screaming in agony, he woke up and they had to postpone the execution. Like, do-over.
I'm sorry. You know what, man? I would just send in some... I'd get like 3 chimpanzees with baseball bats. That would be... That's how you're going to die. They're going to beat you to death and eat your face. You'd be begging for this stuff.
What is this?
So anyway, so what happened was the last time they had an execution in Alabama, the guy kept waking up. And it was a botched execution.
He kept waking up going, man, that was really good. Can I get 5 more minutes?
Actually a sleep study.
Craig asked what it does is it changes the oxygen to nitrogen. So basically you go unconscious. And you die because you're not breathing oxygen anymore.
They don't know if it's going to work.
Well, I mean, what's not to work? You're not getting an oxygen anymore. You're going to die.
Because it's not proven.
No, you will die. What's not proven is you may die with some pain or
right.
And give me a break. Why do you have to be so comfortable when you're dying? Why do we have to let's put a nice pillow on his head? Maybe we'll give him a nice massage.
Let me just say something.
Beat you to death.
The whole purpose of, you know, the way they figure out an execution is for it to be painless and humane. So I say this, you got the guy sleeping already, you know, on death row. He goes to sleep at night. He doesn't know, or sometimes they do know when the date's coming up. So just wait until he falls asleep one night and then cut off his head. That's humane. He's sleeping.
That's no fun, man. Beat him to death with a bat.
Have you ever seen some of these, you know, I mean, look, a lot of people on death row aren't the smartest people in the whole world.
You think?
Have you ever seen their request for what they want as their last meal?
I've seen some
guy will go, you know, I want a T-bone steak. I want a baked potato. You know, I want this, I want that. Oh, that's understandable. The other guy goes, I want a pack of chuckles. I want a Twinkie.
And a Big Mac.
And a Big Mac. You know, it's like, what, are you kidding me?
They want that the shit that gave them comfort as a child. You know, I'm telling you, I'm not a big proponent of making these people as comfortable as possible. You know, I think they should be, they should suffer. They're fucking, I mean, if they've been convicted of these heinous crimes, these murders and whatever, it's like, why should we be so gentle?
How about the electric chair? When they used to use the electric chair, sometimes it would set the guy's head on. Oh, no.
That was fun. I've only seen it in movies because you can't see real footage of it, but it sounds like it would be fun.
Well, the original electric chair went on tour. They called it Old Sparky.
Old Sparky.
Old Sparky.
Yeah. And it went seriously, and it would go from town to town as like a deterrent, you know, for crime. Old yeah. Sparky. And say, on Sparky. It, you know, this chair executed 300 people, you know?
Yeah, pretty wild. I like in the Green Mile when the guy forgets to put the thing on his head, and the guy just freaking catches fire. And I mean,
spoiler alert.
I mean, little, I think,
well, it's a spoiler alert for a freaking 25-year-old movie.
I think my personal opinion is they should put you in a chair, tape you down, and let them watch old videos of some of these comics we started with. Until
oh my god,
no,
you'd be begging. That's cruel and unusual punishment, John.
That's more Guantanamo Bay stuff.
That's cruel and unusual punishment.
I can see the guy in the chair now. Paul Suntop, just kill me. Kill me.
He's been on Facebook a lot lately.
Paul Suntop?
Yeah. We used to call him Paul Sundown.
I call him Paul Sunstock.
I don't even know who it is.
Oh, he's terrible.
This guy that lived in Long Beach. And
I would say it to his face, too. He's terrible.
Not funny at all. But he was always really tan.
When he started off his set by apologizing to every ethnic race there was.
And then insult every single ethnic race, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, he sucks. All right. I don't even know him, but he sucks. Crazy. I hate that lowest comment. And I always had a standard on stage. You know what I mean? Because I always said, first of all, what they told me when I started out, if you drop your drawers, you got nowhere to go from there, you know? So I always prepared my material was always at any given time. I could go on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and do 5 minutes because it was all clean.
How'd that work out for you?
You know what?
I'm kidding.
You know what, John?
You could have been on the Tonight Show.
I put my material up against anybody who ever did the Tonight Show.
Without a doubt. Hey.
The only reason, you know what the reason why guys like me don't get on shows?
What did I used to tell you at the audition nights? You had to go on last, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you were all insulted. And then one day you go, why do I have to go on last? I go, because you're the strongest act I have here. And I need you to save the show.
That's it. I don't know if Craig remembers that. That's it. John used to friggin' save me for points when three or four comics would die. And then he would, and I thought, this guy friggin' hates me, man. I don't know why he just lumps. And then, and I told him one time, and I'm like, what did I ever do to you? And he goes, Mike, he goes, I save you for when the show is dead. He goes, you bring it right back to life.
I think John's full of shit because he put me on first. And I said, John, why are you putting me on first? He goes, oh, I need the strongest comic to warm up the audience.
I started in comedy, this came up the other day. Jackie, the Joke Man Martling, who's going to be on our show in a couple of weeks.
Jackie.
Accused me of not being one of the Magnificent Seven.
You know, and it's funny thing is you said that I never heard of the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, it was Lee Van Cleef, Eli Wallach, John.
The funny part is, and Jackie actually on the show said, how pompous were we that we called ourselves the Magnificent Seven after being on stage like a couple of weeks? The Magnificent Seven were, as I quote, Rob Bartlett, Dave Hawthorne, Jackie Martling, Richie Minervini, Eddie Murphy, Jim Myers, Bob Nelson, and Bob Woods. And then I came along, and they were like, yeah, you're one of the Magnificent Seven. See, that's what makes it a joke. There's really eight of us.
So in other words, the Magnificent Seven were the only seven. You guys are going to call yourself the only seven because you were probably the only seven or eight comics on Long Island.
Now, there were some other ones. There was Kevin Sullivan.
Oh, I remember Kevin Sullivan. He was a funny guy.
Yeah, he was very funny.
I like her face. Now she's a retriever.
Barry Mitchell.
Barry Mitchell, yeah.
Oh, Barry Mitchell. I used to get confused with him all the time. Name wise, not any other way.
It was the guy that you. Oh, there was.
Was Dixon? Was Dixon a comic? I know he owned the club, the Rainy Night. But was he ever a comic?
Dixon was a person. All right. So anyone knows?
He was a Nixon impersonator.
Yeah. Anyone know? We started in a club in Long Island called Richard M. Dixon's White House Inn, and this was a guy who had his face made to look like Nixon.
He got famous impersonating Nixon.
Yeah, but he got a 200,000. This is back in the 70s. He had a $200,000 deal being Nixon with Smirnoff, and it was a picture of him sitting in front of a fireplace with a martini. It was on every billboard,
and he got pretty famous. He got pretty famous for that. Didn't he do a lot of shows?
And he was on a movie.
TV shows, a movie Cold Turkey. He was in.
That's the one where he played Nixon as a baby. Yep.
He came in, and they you couldn't really see him, but he was giving the peace signs. But it was Richard M. Dixon. They just
There was a scene with him where they had an infant in a cradle, and they superimposed his face onto the infant.
Nice.
I always wondered if
his head's out of the blanket and does the double peace.
I always wondered if that's where they got the Reverend Jim from. Like, was he doing a sort of a Nixon? I am no crook. And that's, he sounds like Reverend Jim from Taxi.
This is my story. One day I get a registered letter to my parents' house from the Oval Office.
Yeah.
And it's like presidential seal on it, the whole bit.
From George Washington?
So I go to, and the address is Dixon's. Dixon's White House Inn. Shut up. So I go to Dixon's White House Inn, and it says that I have to meet with Dixon in the Oval Office at 200 p.m. or something. My favorite line.
200 hours.
My favorite line in Spinal Tap is they go, you're going on from 200, what is it, military time?
200 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, 200 hours to 300 hours. The guy goes, we're performing for 100 hours? So I go into the Oval Office, and he has it with a presidential seal behind him. He's in a suit, right? I sit in the chair, and he goes, wah, ha, wah, ha. He goes, welcome to the Oval Office. I just have to tell you a couple of things. Wah. He's crazy. He goes, I've been watching you work for a couple of weeks, and I just have to tell you personally, you've got it. You've got it, God damn it. You have got it. I go like this. I go, well, thanks. And he goes, don't thank me. Thank him, God damn it. And points to the ceiling. And I go, okay. And he goes, meeting over.
Wait, wasn't this one of his famous things? Then he would tell her, you're a spoke. You're a spoke. Like he'd get a group again.
He'd say, oh, yeah. No, what he would do is, I go outside and there's Bob Wood sitting at a table. And I go, he goes, what's this all about? And I told him, he goes, this is bullshit. And he just left. But no, he had a portrait of his face. You know, like how they do psychedelic in the 60s?
Yeah.
So it was a profile of his face. It said, the face, the place, the show, let's go. So before the show, we'd have to be in the back room, and he'd hold up and he goes, the face, the place, the show, let's go. Wah, 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 wah.
That was his pep talk before a show.
And every time he would do it, he'd go, right up the block was a bar called Rum Bottoms.
Rum Bottoms.
And every 2 minutes, he'd go, the face, the place, the show, let's go. And Hawthorne would go, to Rum Bottoms, let's go.
What kind of name is Rum Bottoms?
I never performed at the White House Inn, but I did go there with a friend on a show and got made fun of unmercifully by whoever was on stage. I don't remember who it was, though. I do remember one of his jokes, but I don't
remember. Is that still a thing, you think? I'm people used to always be afraid to sit in the front rows. I remember every time I'd go, I never really messed too much. But afraid.
Well, I was naked, so.
Well, there you go.
Dixon's, we used to get $5 a set, and he would charge us $2.50 for a beer.
So two beers, and you're breaking even.
He wouldn't even give you a free beer, huh?
One night we had a killer show. We were all sitting at the bar. And Hawthorne goes, Maddie, that was Dixon's wife, beers for everybody. And we all have a beer. We already been paid. We all have a beer. And Dixon comes up and goes, oh, that'll be $2.50 each. He goes, Dick, stick it up your ass. We all walked out.
Damn.
Oh, man. Those were the heady days of comedy. I remember them.
All right. One more quick story on this because we don't have a lot to talk about, but this is very funny. One day he tells us, now we're all kind of new at this, right? You know, we've only been doing comedy like a month. So he goes, tomorrow night, there's a big agent coming in and let's see how you do. Right. So we go, okay. So we go in there. And Hawthorne had already been in a comedy team with Billy Crystal and right. had been on like every TV show there was.
Hawthorne was him and Billy Crystal. I knew they were a comedy team. I didn't know shows. No, I knew they were a comedy team. I didn't know
They did Merv Griffin. You know, they did Merv Griffin. They did like a lot of shows. Mm. And then Billy decided he wanted to be an actor and Dave wanted to be a comic. And then Billy ended up being a comic and Dave wanted to be an actor. But anyway, so Dave knew more about show business than all of us because he had apparently been in show business. So we're all like really nervous and we're performing and kind of tripping over ourselves from this big agent. So Hawthorne goes up to the guy and goes, what agency are you with? And he goes, State Farm.
Oh, no.
He just tells handled us, a claim for me.
So he tells us all.
Was it Emu there too?
Yeah. He tells us all that this guy isn't a real agent. He's an insurance agent.
Yeah.
So we go to Dixon as a group, like in the like Frankenstein movie with pitchforks and torches. And we're like, you lied to us. You lied to us. And he goes, let me tell you something. I taught you a lesson. You all sucked. And we did. He goes, you crumbled under the pressure just because you thought there was an agent there. If it was a real agent, you'd be out of the business. Ha! You learned your lesson.
The lesson is it's a true lesson. First of all, you never want to get seen before you're ready. But that's the problem with young comics today. I love when you hear a comic go, and I've heard it how many times, I go, I don't know why this club won't headline me, man. I've been doing comedy for like a year and a half now. It's like, shut up. I just want to stab him. Just want to stab him.
And then you know what? When I look back on it now, at the time we were just so mad. But when I look back at it now, it was really like kind of a cool thing to do. It was a smart thing to do.
It was actually, in retrospect, it was like he showed you that you guys are not as you were probably a little too cocky and he was teaching, bringing you down a peg. You know, not that comics, see, that's what I love about comics. They're either that ego where they think they're the greatest thing in the world or they think they're just fucking horrible. Like, I've seen comics that they get off stage, you get that separation anxiety. You know, it's like because you're on fire. You love being on stage. But as soon as you get off, though, you come back down to reality. And it sucks. You ever get that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
I used to feel like such a fraud for some reason. Like I'd go on stage and I'd be killing it. I get people asking me for like my autograph, take a picture with me and whatever. And then like they'd leave and I would just feel like a piece of shit. And I don't know why.
Well, that was that famous Janis Joplin line. Where she says, I make love to 10,000 people a night and then go home alone.
Yeah, it's the truth.
You know? I only felt that way when I didn't perform to my expectations. I would be like in a downward spiral and I'd be like, I shouldn't be doing this. And then on the way home, I would write more material.
So my big news, guys, is I'm writing a book.
You're writing a book?
What? My life.
He's writing a
book. About your life. So it's a pamphlet? I can't do it. Mike does it all the time. I do one. I get it.
I make fun of his age.
Well, here's the story.
It should be a novel, you know.
I've been going to all these conventions lately and like magic people and paranormal people and everyone keeps going to me. You have so many great stories about your career and everything.
You should
write a book.
And well, I was you like, should. Nobody has better stories than John Ferrantino.
And I was like, what? Who would read it? And
I got the perfect name for it, Outside the Box.
Here's the name of it. My Career, Nothing You Couldn't Do for $29.95.
Nah, you should call it Spooky Stuff Inside. It should be called Spooky Stuff Inside.
That would be on the inside cover.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Danger, spooky stuff inside. But yeah, I'm thinking about doing it. I was talking to my daughter, who's too busy to help me.
She could be your ghost.
She'll write a hell of a forward, though. A hell of a forward.
That's right.
Yeah, she's too busy to help me, but she can steer me in the right direction.
Yeah.
That's great,
man. To the east. Well, over there, Dad. Get over there. Go stand in that corner.
I do have some funny stories, you know?
No, you do. And you
know what you should do? Here's a story that I never told you guys. This is, I think your viewers like, I used to be the MC for a male burlesque show, like Chippendales.
That was you?
Yeah, I was the guy, and I used to book all the comics. So we get this call to go to this mafia club in Hempstead, which used to be a Beefsteak Charlie's. Do you guys know what that is?
I love Beefsteak. Wasn't that free shrimp? So all the shrimp you can eat?
Yeah, it was a Beefsteak Charlie.
For so salad bar.
There, and there was me and Billy Dean, who owned the Bale Burlesque show. We go there, and I was the guy booking all the comedians. So we go there, and there's nothing more rancid than a bar in the morning where it just smells like old beer and cigarettes.
I was a bouncer. You don't have to tell me.
So you know what I'm talking about. It's just disgusting.
It is, and it's so depressing.
Everything feels damp and skeevy.
Yeah, yeah.
So we get to the door, and there's two guys in suits and carnations, like out of Central Casting.
Right.
And they go, Tony D will see you in a few minutes. So we go, okay. So we're waiting there. And you know me, I'm being an idiot. Oh, Tony D's going to see us, you know, right? Not in front of the guys. Not in front of the guys, in front of Billy. He's like, will you stop it? So they take us back. So they take us back. There's a meat locker that used to have all the steaks in it.
That's kind of good.
The guy's offices.
Stripper on the hook.
Inside the meat locker.
Right.
Oh shit!
You go through this big wooden door.
That actually sounds pretty friggin' cool to me.
Right.
You know? So it's soundproof.
This guy's sitting at the desk, right? And the two guys stand behind him with their arms crossed, right? And he goes, "So, tell me about the show." So Billy goes, "It's $1,000 a night." He goes, "You keep the door." He goes, "The dancers get like $250 each." Whoa! How much do the Go-Go Boys get?
Go-Go Boys.
So I'm like laughing. He goes, "Hey, they get $250 each plus the tips they get." He goes, "You get the entire door. You can charge $20 if you want." He goes, "The comic gets $250. And he goes, whoa, the comic gets $250. I can get a carload of comics for $250. Who the fuck is this prima donna?
Oh, shit.
And he points to me. He goes, "He's sitting right here." And the guy goes, "Make me laugh."
Oh, don't you love that? I'll tell you who did that to me.
Wait. It's just a shame this is not a video. I put my hands near my head, and I go, and I just make this stupid face. I go, and the two guys behind the desk, just go, the tension in the room is so bad. They just crack up. And he turns around, he snaps both fingers, he goes, "That is not fucking funny." And they go, and they're trying to hold it in, right? So we leave, we get in the car, we drive about 5 miles, and all of a sudden Billy just pulls over the car and he goes, "What the fuck was that?"
The audience can't see it. There it's an audio. John,
I just made a stupid face and stuck my tongue out. So we get the job, and then we go back to the original club we're working in, which is a Greek mafia club. And the guy goes, "No, you can't take that job. Take that job, you're out."
What are you doing working for mafia clubs anyway?
He's Italian.
I'm Italian. Usually it works out pretty well. And so then we had to go back and tell him we couldn't take the job.
Greek mafia.
Did they offer you the job yet, prima donna?
Yeah, they did. They offered me the job.
So because that shaking your hands and going blah, 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 that really got him.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Greek mafia, when they hit you, it's always from behind. Thank you. I'm here.
You want to know who did that to me? That I hate that when they find you're a comic, make me laugh. I was on an audition for the movie Analyze This.
Right.
Analyze, you know, the first one. Was that Analyze This? Was the first
yeah,
one?
Yes. Analyze This. Yeah.
Walk in the room and who's there? Harold Ramis. I'm reading with Harold Ramis. So first of all, as an actor, I walk in, I see Harold Ramis. And you know, you talk about the level of anxiety goes through the roof. So right. I do the audition, and it was for the part of Jelly. It was supposed to be his best friend and his protagonist. And obviously, I wasn't old enough, but, you know, they got me. Anyway, so I do the audition. He seems happy, and he goes, oh, it says you're a comedian. He goes, make me laugh. And so, you know, I do my thing. I go, you know when you're beating the shit out of a big-time director and, like, right in the middle, you forget – stone face, he didn't fucking smile, he didn't nothing, man. I was shit. God.
Well, remember when we were on the show and we had Tommy Chong on, he was talking about Dave's not here.
Dave's
the whole thing was like an improv, right? Yeah. And they were so happy about it. He said Cheech was outside and he knew he'd be the king of improv, and he kept rapping on there, he's going, let me in, man. And he goes, who?
Yeah.
Dave's not here, man. And he said, and they got in and they played the tape over and over, and they were hysterical. They rushed down, they called a meeting, they got all the heads of the studio sit there, they played it for all of them, and not one person smiled. And he said it turned out to be the biggest bit
there. It was. And the only other person who ever did that to me, as somebody who should have known, definitely known better, was another comedian, was Dice Clay. I opened for him a couple of times, and he was doing, but Dice, when, you know, he said, he goes, he was doing one of his specials, and this was when Dice was on top of the world. This was when Dice was the biggest thing in the world. And so we were doing a thing at Caroline's in the city. It was a benefit for a kid with cancer, and that I'll give him credit for. Dice was, he was a nice guy, you know, he was a really nice guy, raised money for, you know, charities and stuff. But anyway, so we're in the green room in the back. And he goes, you know, I got this thing coming up and, you know, we're going to be doing. And he goes, you know, I'm thinking about putting you on. And Mike, he goes, make me, he goes, and I go, Dice, we've worked here. He goes, yeah. He goes, but I can't come out. I've never seen you. I come out, they go crazy. You know, so he fucking made me do my act for him in the green room. And he was laughing. He was cracking up. And he said, I'm going to give you the thing. It was called the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Mulrooney was on it. Right. And I actually went down and I saw a tape, but I didn't get the part because it went to somebody else. But whatever, I'm not going to go into the politics of it. But it was, I never appreciate that. It's like, you know, when somebody puts you on the spotlight, especially a comic, make me laugh. It's like, you know, we're comedians. It's like, I find that to be just the most disrespectful thing when somebody, even a public, somebody in the public, when they say, you know, oh, you're a comedian, made me laugh. Yeah, go fuck yourself.
Well, it happened to me once. I was coming from a gig at the Interlaken Inn, which is upstate New York. And I was with Quentin Higgs. I don't know if you know Quentin.
He's a
comedian of the African American persuasion. And
we know Quentin Higgs, man.
A very conservative area, I suppose. And we get pulled over, I guess, because I had a taillight or a headlight out.
No, it's because he was black, man. You got probably pulled over because he came black. Over
and he put the flashlight on Quentin and then on me. And he goes, where you guys come from? And we're the Interlaken Inn. He goes, what were you doing there? I go, oh, we're comedians. And he puts a flashlight on my face. He goes, yeah, make me laugh. You know, there's a state trooper. And I'm like, okay, so one time I'm drinking and driving and I'm really drunk and I get pulled over by this cop and he knocks on my window, which is really my head. I'm like, oh, and I do the whole bit and he's just like staring at me. He goes, you get paid for that? I'm like, yeah. He goes, what's in the bag? And I had a little, I was on a diet. So I had peanut butter and a roll in the bag.
Not drugs or nothing, yeah, officer.
And he goes, I go, it's peanut butter and a hard roll. He goes, let me see it. I go, let me see it. I take the bag and I hand it to him. He opens it up, looks into it, and he goes, all right, you guys can get out of here.
My father used to do that. My father used to come with me all the time. I told you he discovered Eddie Murphy. And he used to come with me all the time. So there'd be like a guy like Paul Suntop on stage.
Oh, no.
My dad would look at me really serious and go, what does that guy put on his income tax?
Oh, shit, that's funny.
And I go, what? I go, comedian. He goes, and he hasn't been audited?
Oh, that's funny.
I always thought it was such a funny line.
Let's face it, man. It's 80% of people who call themselves comedians are just terrible. It's only about, I don't even know if it's 20% of comedians that are actually funny.
But I give credit, big props to anybody who has the balls to go on stage and do their own shit, because it's horrifyingly scary the first time you do it.
Yeah, no, no, a total and, props.
But what I can't stand are the people who go up there three or four times and they think they're fucking Eddie Murphy. Or
exactly. No, I got total props for anyone who's got the balls to get on the stage and do their thing. But the thing is in our day, you'd work it out. I mean, you didn't, you had to be doing a comedy for at least a year, year and a half before somebody would even let you MC. And MC was probably the most, one of the most important. It wasn't like it is now, you know, but you did the least time. So
what I said to John before was actually true. Like Jeff Zabrowski, he used to put me on first. And I used to go, why am I always going on first?
Disposable. He said,
because I need somebody strong, you know, to get the show going. And I believe Jeff,
John did that work. Did that work, John?
No, but the thing is, being you know JJ Boyd,
sure, yeah. Sure.
Well, when I used to host an open mic at McGuire's, and I always used to put him on first. He goes, dude, why are you putting me on first? I go, Jay, the first job you're ever going to get is an MC,
right?
So you should really learn how to work with a cooler audience and get them going.
Even when you were a character, my first job was all MC.
He's always thanked me for that, by the way.
Yeah, it is. And it's the toughest job there is, because you're the one who has to take a bunch of strangers and turn them into an audience.
That's right.
And the truth is it doesn't matter if you do well or not, because even if you don't do well as the MC, you've still unified them and they hate you.
Again, I wrote this book in 1984.
You can't read it. It's an invisible book.
It doesn't matter. I'll read you what it says. It says Comedy Clubs for Magicians.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And it tells you how not to be a dick.
I thought it said, is that a balloon? Is that a balloon in your pants? Or you
and
just
on the back, it says, warning, this book is not machine washable, dry clean only. But inside included, listen to this, in 1984, it's a list of 120 comedy clubs.
Oh, cool. Where, and that was probably, and that was what, across the country or just in the tri-state area?
Across the country. And I wonder if how many of these are still available.
There's probably a lot of them that aren't. There's still a lot of places that do comedy, but they're not official comedy clubs. It's a weird thing, man. It's like,
look, Dangerfield's closed, Caroline's closed.
Yeah,
I mean, the pandemic knocked out some.
Those were showcase clubs. Those weren't paying. I mean,
the New York Improv closed.
You couldn't make money in those clubs, real money. You couldn't make a living. Those were showcase clubs. I think John's talking about clubs where you can actually make a living.
No, it's true, but they were iconic clubs, and if they go, then the other ones have, like, you know.
It's a sign of the times.
Part of the book, I have diagrams, and it's like a square room, like.
You got 48 colored glossy pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was about. Funny.
I have a diagram of a square room, how they usually set up the tables. So figure two, a square room. Figure three, a rectangular room. Figure four, a mushroom.
Mushroom.
Oh, God. what is the worst setup room? I mean, as far as the setup goes, you ever worked in? I know mine.
Oh, it's like whenever if you go to do like a corporate show, they're at dinner tables eating and they're 40 feet away from the stage.
It's those big ballrooms where they have those big round tables and you're on a stage, right? You're a half a mile away on a stage and you're like 10 feet high in the air. Right. They're, you know, far away. For me, I always love the audience close by. I like that intimate setting. If I'm doing, I want to be able to look them in the eye, see them right there in front of me.
Well, that's when comedy's the best, obviously.
Yeah, but you know, listen, you're gonna, even if you do comedy now, you're gonna run into tons of places because that is
one-nighters generally had the worst setups, from in my opinion,
because they're run by people that don't know what they're doing. You know,
now there's probably one that you guys may have worked at, Lackawanna Station. Did you ever work at that one?
Nope.
It's in Scranton, Lackawanna train station. They had comedy in a part of the station that was made out of an old railroad car.
Wow.
It was also a bar. So you get on the stage, which was basically just risers, you know, and in front of you was the bar, and the audience was sitting to the left and to the right, not in front of you, and they were in booths.
Yeah, that's just
that was
terrible.
The hardest room to, I mean, that room just sucked.
The weirdest one I've ever did was in Atlantic City, opening for Crosby, Stills, and Nash outside, and it was, they set up like a stadium for 6,000.
Shit.
And then behind us.
What a tough gig.
And then behind us was about another 1,800 on terraces.
Behind you?
Yeah.
No, in front of you.
The equivalent that I can say to that, John, is I remember playing the bar in a bowling alley. Every time you do a joke and you don't know if you like you're hearing stuff and I'm going, did somebody just get a strike or was right. that a funny yeah. or is that a funny joke?
You know? Okay. So listen to this. I get the job work. So I do Westbury Music Fair and I do Valley Forge Music Fair. They're like 3,800 seat theaters.
Was it strange going back to Valley Forge after all that time?
So anyway, I get a job. My first gig with them is Daytona Beach. And my manager, Andy Talbert's going to go with me. It's called the Daytona Beach Ocean Center. So we have the address and we pull up and we drive around and I go, this can't be it. I don't see the tour buses. And Andy goes, yeah, neither do I. This is weird. Let me go out of the car and ask. So he says, hey, I'm with John Fortuna's the opening act. We don't see the tour buses. And the guy goes, oh, they're parked inside next to the stage. Three tour buses inside next to the stage. Mm. We walk in there and it seats about, I don't know, 12,000, I guess.
So what was that like, John? What is it like to play for some, I mean, do you think they were really paying attention?
Did you really get them? I'll tell you, the way it worked was it took so long for me to get somebody up on stage that I was actually asking for a volunteer for the next trick that I was going to do.
Yeah. Oh, so you were still doing the volunteer stuff.
Okay. So what happened was they had video. You know,
because in like a stadium, you think that people would have trouble seeing, you know,
big video screens, gotcha. Like billboards.
Gotcha, right.
And so my opening of the show was they would introduce me. I'd come walking out and I have a boombox radio in the middle of the stage. Big, like that guy.
With Angel Salazar.
Yeah, one of those on the stage.
Check it out, man.
I'd walk out on stage and I'd turn it on. And then I would start dialing it down, and it was a tape. Like, and I'd get to Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, and they would go crazy. And I'd go, no. I'd look over my shoulder and just go by. And I would go down a little bit further, and I'd get to a Neil Young song, and they'd go crazy again. And I go,
because that would be like a weird clue that they would think Neil Young's going to come out.
Yeah. Right. And I'd go, no. And I'd turn it past me, another Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, and then I just zipped through it. And then I got to this thing called, it was Two Live Crew, and the song was She Got a Big Old Butt. And I would sit there and go, and it'd be like, boom, dum, dum, dum. And on a rock stereo system, this is painful, right? And I would just like look at it, and I'd like start shaking my head, like, I like this music, and I would just make it louder. And you could just see these people's faces, like, what the fuck is this all about?
Right.
And I'd take off my suit jacket and I'd cover the radio and I'd pick it up off the table and I'd walk forward and I'd throw my jacket up in the air and the radio would vanish. The music would stop and I'd go, don't you hate that music? And they'd go, blah. And that's how I started.
Now, here's a question. Yeah. Did Crosby, Stills, and Nash ever get kind of pissy that you were like putting on a Neil Young song? I mean, were they buddies?
No. They thought it was really funny. You know? And But the crazy part was when you would do a joke, if it was a good joke, it would go out.
Yeah, that I've experienced.
Come back. It would just go out, but it wouldn't come back.
I played, it was a college gig, and the theater was, it held about 3,000 or 4,000 people.
Right.
And it was round, Sure. And that was the same thing. It was like you'd do something. And it took a minute to get to them, and not a minute, but it took a few seconds to get to them. And then
it seems like an eternity.
Seemed like an eternity. It would really mess up your timing, you know.
I worked at the Comac Arena. I opened for Judy Tenuta, and I just got there. I did two gigs that night, so I did the first gig, and I just got to this gig on time. And Judy goes, "Have you ever done this?" She was really nice. She goes, "Have you done a venue like this before?" I'm like, "No." She goes, "Wait for the laugh."
You gotta wait. Yeah,
she said, "Wait for the laugh." And I'm glad she told me that, or else it would have been a disaster. It's
Judy Tenuta comes full circle. Sticking the bubble gum on Chauncey Howell's nose.
Did See, those were the those were the weird yes. wait for Did the
she? I well, was that's doing, that's how I met Chauncey Howell. He was in the Wings.
I was no. So what happened was we were doing what is that Bryant Park? And they every Friday they would do comedy in the park,
right?
And it was 12 noon till 1:30, I think. And people would come bring their lunch and their blankets, and they would sit in the park in the springtime. And
while I can see a guy like you doing really well with something like that, yes.
No. So I was with Judy Tenuta, right? And so ABC News came down or whatever channel he was
Mr.
on.
Mr. Howe.
He's backstage interviewing us, and I'm sitting there with Judy, and we're talking. And he goes, so how long are you doing comedy? And she reaches in her mouth, takes out a wad of gum, and she goes, why do you care, pig? And sticks it on his nose.
Which was what Judy was kind of famous for being just like that.
But that night on the news, I guess they all thought Chauncey Howell was really annoying. They kept going, after this word coming up, why do you care, pig? They showed it about 5 times. And every time they showed it, they just cut to like everyone in the studio hysterical laughing.
I miss Chauncey.
I miss Judy.
I don't miss anybody.
She was really sweet and she's very,
she was
very
really fun. She was really
she was
nice
so fearless and so funny, man. She really was.
She was really nice. The domestic goddess.
Yeah, that was a huge venue. I don't know how many.
No, the domestic goddess was Roseanne Barr, which oh my god, I never found anything funny about her.
No, but so did Judy used to say that. She was a domestic goddess way before Roseanne Barr.
I think she was some other kind of god, not a domestic goddess. She was just a goddess or something like that.
I like Roseanne's early stand up too.
I like that laugh, Juliet.
And she was dating Emo Phillips.
They were married.
They were married?
Yeah, that's like straight... to be a fly on that wall.
Oh, yeah. I think they're probably normal people when they're not on stage.
No,
well, you know,
she was really normal to me.
Well, listen, Emo Phillips, right? I did a few gigs with him, and he would tell the club owners that he didn't need a hotel room. Because he sleeps at the train station or sleeps at the bus station.
That's so nice.
All he got to do is drop him off at the bus station after the show. So I did a gig. I was opening for him for like a week.
What, does he sleep in his own suitcase?
No. As soon as you got to the bus, as soon as you left, he goes, just tell me you're taking me to the bus station. He would go right to the really nice hotel and he would check in. And take a cab to a block away from the club and then walk the last block.
So he would pay for his own.
It was just part of his persona.
Yeah.
So he would pay for in a really nice hotel out of his own pocket.
Right. But what he would do is he would say, I don't need a hotel room, so just give me extra money.
Oh, I got you. Right. Okay.
Yeah, and he would pay for the hotel room himself.
Well, how many gigs? John, I don't think you probably did this a lot, maybe early in your career. But how many, I remember, I used to love gigs. Like I had one that was up in Plattsburgh. It was a one-nighter for the Brawny Paper Towel Company. And I drive all the way up there and the gig paid like $500 plus $80 for a hotel room.
Right.
I didn't get a hotel room. I just drove home. Did you ever do that shit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you just keep the money.
back in those days, are you kidding? Man, there was a reason they called us starving artists because we were freaking starving. I kept every penny I could.
That's right. So I'm not going to
sleep
in
my car. I'd sleep in my car and keep the money. Who cares? You know?
I didn't get home until 6 a.m, but it was worth it.
But then there were the gigs that came with either the condo or the hotel room, and they didn't weren't going to give you the money. They would just I would take that.
Condos on the
road. I never stayed in a condo. Thank God.
Oh my God! Some of those condos. You know the old joke, right? The comic shows up at the gig, and he goes, "So what's the deal here?" The guy goes, "It's the best gig you're ever going to have in your life." He goes, "We pay you in advance every night." He goes, the audience applauds the setups. You'll get a standing ovation 2 or 3 times during your show. You can have anything you want on the menu to eat. We pick you up in a limo. We take you home in a limo. And he goes, come on, what's the catch? He goes, there is no catch. And he goes, really? He goes, we finished? He goes, yeah, now Lucifer will take you back to the condo.
All right, guys, we have our 2-minute warning, just letting you know.
Oh, cool.
I used to love some of the road gigs just because it was fun. It's like, it's almost like, you know how you never know these are the best times of your life when they're happening. I knew it then because it's like you can't describe the magic of getting up on a stage in front of like, you remember little small intimate places where the audience is right there, and you get on the stage and you've got that connection and they're laughing. There's no drug that gets you higher than that. I knew at that time that it's never going to get better. This is it. Right. This is, even if you get famous and you do whatever, this being good when nobody knows who you are.
I was working in New Mexico once, right?
Yeah.
And I look in the audience and this guy walks in. He's got on, really good looking guy too. He was about 6'2", really good looking guy, hair perfect. He had on a cowboy shirt, a big belt buckle, jeans, cowboy boots, and one of those long rider jackets.
Right. Duster. I love those jackets.
Had on a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of my show and I just go, you know, if a rodeo were to break out, you're the only one prepared. And he looks at me and he goes, hey, man, please don't bust my balls. I just came into town for some supplies and a little entertainment. It's like, come on. That's the heart of America, man.
Yeah, no.
You know what I mean?
The heart of America. I just really came in for some supplies.
Before we go, can you guys name your favorite club to work of all time?
That's tough, man.
And not necessarily because of the amenities, but because you had the shows there.
I'll be honest and say it's a toss, but for me, between Chuckles and Jimmy's Comedy Alley. I loved them both because they treated me like a star, you know, and the audiences were always great. I mean, Chuckles, the audiences were just always, Long Island audiences are amazing. I think they love comedy. They're supportive. I mean, it was the best place to develop as a comic.
You know, I had the best shows in my career, and yeah. I still, the Comedy Den in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Every time I went there, I freaking.
That's because nobody spoke English.
Well, yeah, I did a physical comedy, man. It's not easy to do physical comedy for 40 minutes.
To me, it was always East Side.
I loved East Side. It's my home club, but
it was like our clubhouse.
Struggled a lot at East Side too, though. I have some tapes on sets on tape that are just so hard to watch.
Richie Minervini just told me the other night that he was going through his storage unit and found the box of 400 videotapes from the East Side.
Oh, he's got to do something.
Well, if they haven't already degraded, they might have degraded already.
I know. You guys, I'm pretty sure I got like the first spots that Eddie Murphy ever did. And
oh, he's got to do something with that. Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Well, I'm so glad we had this time.
Before John says goodbye, I got to do this because it's just not me. I apologize for the pamphlet joke. You know, I idolize your career. I was just trying to be funny. And sometimes.
What, my book? It is a fucking pamphlet.
No. When you said you're writing a book.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. No, I never thought anyone would be interested in anything. And everyone's going, oh, you got great stories. You really need to put them in a book.
Yeah. That's true.
Like, my podcast is my legacy. I mean, every story I've ever known is on there. And they go, yeah, but if you could read the story about Woodstock in a book and
oh man, yeah,
you know, the woman peeing on herself,
expand on it.
I think that it's a great idea. I think if you can get people to to know who you are and get them to buy it and read it, the stories and all your stories are just fabulous. I love your stories.
Well, we'll be waiting for more updates on the progress of the book.
Yeah, we may be waiting a while. It's a big project.
All right, say goodnight, Gracie.
Meanwhile, I just have to show you this. I told you before. You can buy these on Temu. They're little business cards, and they say you get a stack of their orange. They look like fluorescent orange. You get a stack of them for like $1.38, and you keep a couple in your wallet, and it says, learn to drive. You accidentally park like an asshole. Get the help you need before becoming a shithead that everyone hates.
And that was a totally unsponsored plug for Temu,
which I've never heard anything good about. So
I hope
I can't believe it. Then obviously anyone that's ever been.
I love Temu.
I'm not talking about this stuff. I'm talking about I've heard that, you know, that there's supposedly, people can easily steal your credit card information.
No, it's bullshit.
That's why I use a debit card that I only load once.
That's why I use American Express because American Express
or PayPal.
Don't leave home without it, John.
One thing about Temu is because it's China, there's this big Republican thing. That's the reason why they don't want you to use TikTok. Meanwhile, the TikTok store is really good.
See? Another plug. We need
TikTok. I know we should be making, right. We didn't plug unless we make money. Anyway, say goodnight, Gracie.
Meanwhile, I just have to tell you,
we had 42 times you fucking tried to say goodbye. I just want to say, hold on, wait a minute.
Listen, we had 14 sponsorships the other day.
John's book is going to be 6,000
pages long. We had 14 sponsors, and the crazy part was, three of them were different lawyers.
Let me just tell you what Tommy Chong has to say about that and his wonderful CBD oils.
Unless he starts giving them to you. How's that
working? Now, wait, what happened? You need to talk to Jay about we're supposed to get live. I thought we were going to do live commercials, man. I want to do some live commercials, Jay.
Magnesium. It's what you need.
You know, I have the exact same magnesium in my closet. I took some today.
It's very good.
All my doctor recommended about magnesium. We're really old. We got
that's go. Nature's
talk
made.
Talk to you later. Magnesium. Goodbye. See us wherever you see your podcast. Wherever you, yeah.
Right. See us on Spotify, the Podcast Playground, Apple Podcast. We're podcasting all over the podcast place.
Or wherever you get reception, if you just ride into town for some entertainment.
Just adjust your rabbit ears and you'll get us. You'll see. Okay, Craig. Say goodnight.
Goodnight.
Night, Lucy.
Lucy?